All right, now, today is the first of those three meetings I told you about that will feature a report. All right? So eventually you'll be handing in a report from what you do today. And the procedure is not too difficult. It's outlined in the lab manual that you just got. But before we get to that, I need to go over today's important concepts. One of which is careful liquid measurement. We measure liquids in biology all the time for various reasons, and there are various tools to do the job. You can see a bunch of glassware and plasticware sitting on your trays. By the way, what are the proper names for these things? What is this? That's a beaker. What about the ones that are conical? It is an Erlenmeyer flask, or just a flask. And what about these other ones? Those are graduated cylinders, exactly. And that's all that you have sitting there. Those can all be used to contain liquids. And notice that they all have markings on them for volume. But that doesn't mean that they're all appropriate for actually carefully measuring volumes of liquid. A beaker, for instance, is not what you would use to carefully measure liquid. That would be only roughly, if you didn't really care about a careful measurement. Or just to give you a rough idea of how much is in the beaker. If you really want to accurately measure liquids, you would use a graduated cylinder rather than a beaker. Now, strictly speaking, they're both cylinders, right? A graduated cylinder and a beaker are both cylinders, both right circular cylinders. Why is the graduated cylinder better for the job? And don't overthink this. What is the difference between these two, if I were to ask a kindergartner? One is tall and narrow. The other one is very wide, right? It's that width that makes a beaker a bad tool for carefully measuring liquids. Because if you have a specific volume of liquid that you pour into a cylinder, the narrower that cylinder is, the higher the level is going to rise, right? And if you then add more liquid, meaning you change from one volume to another, in a narrow cylinder, that's going to cause a greater change in levels than an equal change in volume would in something that's very wide. Does that make sense? Well, that means it's not a difference in the change in volume in those two examples. It's just that change in volume is manifested in a greater change in levels in the narrower cylinder, and therefore you can easily tell the difference between, if it's a small change, you can easily tell the difference the narrower the diameter is. You know, if you want to measure a half a liter of water, you don't put it onto a sheet pan that'll just barely fill it, right? You want to put it into something narrow so you can tell easily on your tick marks that could be spread out more. So that's why you use a graduated cylinder. But more specifically, you always should use the smallest graduated cylinder that is big enough for the job. You know, you have a couple sizes here, and there are other sizes, of course. If you're going to measure a liter of water, you wouldn't want to use the little one, even though it is narrower than this one, right? Because doing so, you'd have to make a lot of measurements, each of which individually has some error associated with it. And if you therefore have to make a lot of measurements, you have the potential for a lot of errors to add up and make a big error. If you have a graduated cylinder that's a liter or more in volume, that would be the one to use in that case, because then you'd only have to make one measurement. So always use the smallest one that will allow you to do it in one shot. If you're talking about much smaller volumes of water or liquid in general, for instance, not just a tenth of a mil, but microliter, or a tenth of a milliliter, but rather microliters, then you wouldn't use a graduated cylinder of any type. Strictly speaking, it is kind of a graduated cylinder, but it gets a different name, which is a pipette. A pipette is an even much smaller or narrower tube, and there are big pipettes and small pipettes. The smaller the volume of liquid that you have to deliver, the more you get into micro pipettes, which are tools we'll be using later that you put tips on and you can dial in a specific volume that it will suck up, basically. So you'll get introduced to those later. But anyway, that's what I'm talking about for careful liquid measurement. When you looked at the PDF and did the pre-lab, I think it says something about a meniscus in there, doesn't it? What is a meniscus? That's right. It's the curvature of the surface of the liquid in a narrow column. In other words, if you put liquid into a graduated cylinder or any narrow tube, it does not have a surface that's perfectly level, which is problematic. It would be nice if that were the case, right? Because then you could just easily match it up with the graduations or the tick marks to get the accurate measurement. But that's not what liquids do. They form curvatures called menisci. And there are two kinds. There can be a negative meniscus, like that, a downward curvature, or a positive meniscus, an upward curvature. Whether it makes a negative or a positive meniscus depends on the nature of the liquid. We'll only encounter negative menisci in here because all the liquids will be water-based. Mercury, for instance, though, is a liquid that forms a positive meniscus. Either one, though, is a curvature, and therefore it's ambiguous with respect to where the actual level is. If you think about getting an accurate measurement, you would want to try to force it to not be curved and instead be nice and level like I was showing. Right? Because then that would be real. That would be the real measurement. But you never do that, of course. You just leave the curvature as it is. So we have to deal with that uncertainty, and we do that by convention, which in science is just an agreement on how to do things. Everyone does it the same way. For a meniscus, we've agreed that we should measure it at the extent of the curve in the middle between the two walls. So for a negative meniscus, it's the bottom part, even though that's not actually correct, right? Because there's still a little bit of liquid here and here. We still say that's where you measure it at. And for a positive meniscus, it would be measured at the top. In both cases, it's right in the middle of the curvature. Doing that means getting your eye at the level of the graduated cylinder. So you don't pour liquid into a graduated cylinder and then look at it from up here. You get what is called parallax error, which occurs when you look at something from the wrong angle. For instance, you know, if I make a mark here and I put my hand here and I say, is this mark to the right or to the left of my hand? Well, it depends on where you're viewing it from, right? That changes. Ideally, you want to be looking at something straight on. That's why nowadays most things are LED readouts on gauges, but the gauges used to have needles. And the scale would be written in letters behind the needle. The needle would be in front. Well, if you looked at it from the wrong angle, it would look like it's matched up to the wrong tick mark. So the real high quality ones would have a little mirror right here. And the needle's in front of it. And the reason the mirror is there is that you look at it in such a way that you don't see a reflection. That makes you look straight onto it. And you should do the same thing with a graduated cylinder. Get down to the level of the liquid to carefully measure the curved part of the meniscus. All right. Now for four more definitions. Solution, solvent, and solute go hand in hand. A solution is one type of mixture. There are different kinds of mixtures in chemistry, but a solution is a specific kind of mixture in which something is dissolved in something else. Okay? So solutions involve dissolving. The solution is the overall mixture. It has two components, though. Two categories of components. The solvent is the part of the solution that is doing the dissolving. And it's usually most of the material in the solution. The solute, which there can be one or more kinds of, is what is being dissolved by the solute. By the solvent. And then the overall combination is the solution. So what is the solution today that we're working with? What is the solution?
Water.
No, water is the solvent.
Salt.
No, salt is the solute.
Salt
water is the solution. Water is the solvent. It's doing the dissolving. Salt is being dissolved, so it's the solute. Actually, I should say that there are two solutes. Because when sodium chloride, which is the kind of salt we're using, gets dissolved, it breaks into two ions, sodium ions and chloride ions. So there's really two different solutes. But you put it in as one compound as a solute. Okay, so that's the difference between those three. Molarity is just one way of measuring concentration. Concentration is a measure of how strong a solution is. What I mean by strength of solution is a comparison of how much solute there is for a given amount of solvent. For salt water, the saltier the salt water is, the higher the concentration of salt is in that solution. Okay? Well, there's different ways you can measure that, different units you can use. Molarity is one way of measuring it. That's what we'll be using in here. Molarity has units called molar, which is abbreviated capital M. Notice that's not confusable with mega, which is also capital M, because you would never use mega by itself. M by itself is molar. And it is a derived unit, so it's made up of other units. The definition of molar is moles of solute per liters of solution. All right. So, an exactly one molar salt solution has one mole exactly of salt. Do you remember what a mole is? Avogadro's number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power. That number of formula units, actually I haven't gotten to that in lecture yet, but that number of particles of salt per, in every exactly 1 liter of overall solution, not per liter of water, per liter of solution, including the salt. All right? You're using different concentrations today in your experiment. And you're not doing anything with these. These are just to show you how much salt is in the solutions you're going to use. The solutions have already been pre-mixed. But this is one mole of salt. This is 3, and this is 5. So if you dissolve this amount of salt, 1 mole, in exactly enough water to make the overall volume of the mixture, the solution, 1 liter, then that is a 1 molar solution. So that much water, that much salt has been dissolved into this bottle. That's 0 molar. That's just pure water. This is the 1 molar solution. This much solution contains that much salt, and so on for the 3 and the 5. Just to give you an idea of how much a mole is of salt in this case. All right. Next is physical and chemical changes. I kind of got into this today, earlier in the lecture. A chemical change is one that actually results in new substance. There's a change in substance, right? It's not the same stuff. A physical change does not. There's a change, but you still have the same stuff. And so, for instance, you're boiling these solutions today, including one so-called solution, the zero molar solution. Technically speaking, it's not really a solution, right? Because it doesn't have any solute. Zero molar means there just isn't any solute in it. It's just pure water. But when you boil that, there is a change occurring because you're transforming liquid water into water vapor. But that is not a change in substance. It's all water molecules. If you look at an individual water molecule, it doesn't make sense to say whether it's liquid or gas. The states of matter, liquid, gas, solid, those have to do with how multiple particles are associated. And that doesn't change when you boil water. I mean, the association changes, but the molecules don't change. What is the difference, by the way? What makes something a liquid compared to a gas? What's the big difference? Not necessarily, because you can have the same temperature in two different states, and that's what temperature has to do with the speed. What is it? It's the spacing that really defines the two. In a gas, there is a lot of space between particles. They're colliding, bouncing off of each other, but it's mostly space. In a liquid, they're much, much closer together. And that's why liquids have such higher density, because density is the amount of matter per unit volume. But that definition should tell you that when you boil water and change it from liquid to a gas, you're not actually changing the water. The individual molecules are just still water. They're just spaced farther apart when they escape the liquid and go into the gas phase. That's not a chemical change, that's a physical change. All right, now, this is the first of the reports. And by the way, I told you on that first day that the reports are not formal reports. It's just a matter of answering questions. Well, the lab report directions are on page 41. So when you actually submit this on Canvas, remember it has to be a Word document, and anything that you draw by hand, a graph drawn by hand or anything, has to be photographed first and then inserted into the Word document. You upload only the Word document on Canvas. That's all it will accept is a .docx file. Only one also. So just a .docx. Anyway, when you make your report, it's simply a matter of answering all these questions on this lab report directions page. All right? Just don't forget about the deadline, which is already on Canvas. To do a report, since you have to submit a graph, though, that we need to talk about graphing techniques, and even before that, scientific variables. So there are all kinds of variables. Variables, of course, can vary. That's why they're called that. But in any given scientific experiment, there are 3 categories of variables, which are independent variables, dependent variables, and controlled variables. Now, why do we undergo any any scientific experiment? Specifically, to test whether a prediction that corresponds to a hypothesis will come true or not. Right? Remember the flashlight example on the slide in class? A hypothesis is an explanation, so it usually has because in it. Such and such is this way because explanation. That's a hypothesis. And it's stated as though it is true. Whether it is or not, you don't know. But you state it as though it's true. It's declarative. That logically leads to a prediction. In other words, if that hypothesis is true, then this should happen. That's a prediction. And scientific experiments are just a formal way of testing whether that prediction comes true or not to tell you whether the hypothesis is wrong or not. All right? Well, there's all kinds of variables, like I said, but almost all of the variables in the universe have nothing to do with the experiment at hand, and they can only confuse matters. So even though they are variables, we want to do what we can to keep them from varying if they have nothing to do with the experiment, so that they won't cause changes in the results that aren't due to what you're trying to test. And those are the controlled variables. It's best if I just use an example so you can get a real-world feel for this. Let's say that I'm doing an experiment to test what the effect of the concentration of some nutrient solution is on the growth rate of a plant. I want to see how much, if at all, changing the concentration of a nutrient solution affects how quickly a plant grows in a given amount of time. So there are all kinds of variables, right, that don't have anything to do with this experiment. I don't want them to actually be variables, even though they are. So I want to, as part of my preparation, keep those unrelated things constant in all of my different replications that I use in the experiment. For instance, the amount of sunlight, I want to make sure that's the same for all of the plants I use. So it's not a variable. That's a controlled variable. I want to give them all the same amount of water. I want to have them all be the same species to start with and the same size to start with. Same amount of soil, same type of soil, same pots, same kinds of pots. Those are all controlled variables. Okay? That leaves the other two categories, and those are part of the experiment, which are the independent variable and the dependent variable. Careful with these because students mix these up pretty routinely. Now you can think about it linguistically, which I usually encourage, but in this case, I think it's best to just think about the practical definitions of these two. In other words, how you actually use them in science. The dependent variable in an experiment is the variable that you, as the scientist, measure. The independent variable, on the other hand, is the thing that you, as the scientist, adjust from replicate to replicate. So think back to my example, the plant experiment. What is the dependent variable in that experiment?
The same plant.
No, that's not what you're measuring. The dependent variable is what you measure. The growth rate. Right. So you measure how much longer each one got, let's say, in a week or whatever. That's the growth rate. You're measuring that in the experiment. That's the dependent variable. You can think of it as the effect. What about the independent variable in that experiment? The concentration of nutrient solution. You give a different concentration to each of your replicates. That's what you're adjusting as the scientist. All right? Now, linguistically speaking, the names also make sense. The dependent variable is called the dependent variable because the value of the dependent variable might actually depend on what the value of the independent variable is. That's what you're actually trying to find out in an experiment. But that's why it's called dependent variable. In other words, in this plant example, it might be true that the growth rate of the plant actually depends on the concentration of nutrient solution that you give it. Dependent variable depends on the independent variable. It's also possible that it might not depend at all, but we still call it the dependent variable. All right? When it comes time to graphing, which is often done in science, because a graph is a full of information that just you can get at a glance. So they're really efficient ways of conveying information. But in a typical two-dimensional graph, which most scientific graphs are, there are two axes, of course, vertical and horizontal axis. But there's only one proper way of plotting these two categories. Well, there's three categories of variables, right? Which one does not belong on a graph at all? The controlled variables. You're not doing any sunlight or anything like this on this graph. But that leaves the other two categories. Which one should be on the horizontal axis? The independent variable. And you would never label a graph independent variable. I'm just putting this here to show you which one goes where. So in terms of mathematical functions, if you think of this as a function, the independent variable is the x value. It's the input into the function. The dependent variable always goes on the vertical axis. It's like the y. It's the output. Like I said, the effect, right? So what you're trying to determine in an experiment is whether changing this x value has an effect on the y value. Changing the independent variable, does that affect the dependent variable? Other way around is, does this variable that's called the dependent variable, regardless, actually indeed depend on the independent variable? Well, you can find that out once you actually put in your data points that you obtain by measuring. Right? So, let's say I have some points here. These don't fall on a line. They're not perfectly collinear. But they suggest that there's a linear relationship. It's not perfect collinearity because every measurement has some error associated with it, a real measurement, right? But it doesn't look random. It does look like there's a trend here. And it's an upward trend. Well, when you have a somewhat linear relationship hinted at by your data, you're justified in fitting a line to the data, a line of best fit. Which, by the way, does not necessarily go through any of your points. It might or might not. The line of best fit, which you can do by hand or by computer, is just the line that gets as close as possible to as many as possible of the points. And the computer figures that out more or less perfectly, but you can do it just visually if you do a hand graph with a ruler. But a transparent ruler is really handy here because then you don't cover some of the points. But I'll just roughly draw a line of best fit here. Actually, that's not very good. It looks like it should be about right there. Anyway, whatever the line of best fit is, that tells you quickly and visually what the relationship is between the two variables. And this has a positive slope, which means that the dependent variable in this case actually does seem to depend on the independent variable. A negative slope, downward facing, also means that there's a dependence, right? In the opposite direction, but it's still a dependence. In other words, you change X, that changes Y. But if you had data that looked like that, the line of best fit would be perfectly horizontal. What is the slope of a horizontal line? It's a zero slope. A horizontal line tells you that even though you call that thing the dependent variable, you've shown that it really is not dependent on the other variable. Because no matter what you make the X, you get the same Y. Okay? That's what you really are testing in experiments, the dependence of one variable over the other. Now, a line of best fit is nice visually, but that's not the only use of it. A line of best fit is an important measuring device in its own right. And that brings up this last bullet point on the slide here. It allows for prediction. Now, the raw data are the dots on the graph. Those are the things that you actually got measurements for. But once you've shown that there's a trend and you've fitted a line to it, the line itself allows you to predict values for the dependent variable corresponding to values of the independent variable that you didn't actually test. That's why it's a prediction, because you didn't actually go through with that. In other words, these have X values, these two dots, right? Those, in this case, the independent variable is concentration of solution, which you should always fully label, not just like I did. And if there are units, which there usually are, you should have your units in parentheses. So, for instance, if I measure my plant nutrient solution in molar, it would be capital M in parentheses. So this is some value of molar, and this is another value. Well, maybe I'm interested in what the dependent variable, the growth rate, would be in between these two, which I didn't actually measure, right? The trend line can give you that prediction. But there are two categories of predictions using trend lines. Two methods of using a trend line, and that's what interpolation and extrapolation are. They're really the same method, but we use two different words to describe them because they're important in a way that I'll describe. Interpolation, inter means between, right? Interpolation is using a trend line to predict the value of the dependent variable for an independent variable value that's between values that you actually measured. So anyway, this is the lowest one you measured. This is the highest one that you actually measured. Using this line between these two values of X would be interpolation.
Can you repeat that definition?
Yeah, it's interpolation is using the trend line for any value of the independent variable between the lowest and the highest actually measured. Within your range of measurement, in other words. Now, graphically speaking, interpolation is simply a matter of choosing whatever independent variable value you're interested in. Let's say it's this, whatever this is on the x-axis. Go straight up to the fitted line, and then straight over from the fitted line to the y-axis. and then read that value. That's the dependent variable, that in this case it would be growth rate, that you would expect if you had actually gone through with making a concentration of this value and given it to the plants. That's interpolation. Well, you can do exactly that same technique, except outside of the range that you actually measured in. For instance, you could do it down here below your lowest, or you could do it anywhere here above the highest. If it's outside of the range, then it's extrapolation. Extra means outside of. Why do we bother to give these two same techniques different words? Because one of them is much better scientifically than the other. Interpolation is much safer than extrapolation. And you want to avoid extrapolation. Because there's a lot more uncertainty associated with it. For instance, this does look like there is a linear trend, which suggests that the higher the concentration is of the nutrient solution, the more the plants grow. But that does not mean it's going to continue indefinitely, right? If you actually went through with making stronger and stronger solutions, maybe it actually eventually gets so strong that it will kill the plant, and your real data would fall off a cliff. Well, if you trust extrapolation, you would say it's way up here for this value rather than way down here. All right? On the other hand, if you stick within your range, it's unlikely that something bizarre is happening between points that you actually measured. And that's why the more measurements you make for more values of X, the more certain you can be about the line fit. All right? You wouldn't want to do it with just two points, because of course there can be a perfect line fit between any two points. But it might be that this is the actual behavior. But if you get a lot of points and they all fall on that line, you can be pretty certain that line fit is correct. Does all that make sense? All right, those are the concepts. Just have a couple things to say about the procedure to do it well. Whenever you're writing things up, well, just in general, you want to do a good job, but you want to do a good job on your experiments when you write them up, because they're just a hell of a lot easier to describe things when they go well, rather than trying to have to explain why you had problems. Pretty simple to a straightforward procedure. All you're really doing is boiling liquids and measuring their temperature. But you specifically are measuring the temperature at boiling, in other words, the boiling point of each liquid. That's just a matter of sticking a thermometer in it, but you can even get that wrong. For instance, of course it's important for the tip of the thermometer to be fully submerged to get a good temperature, and for you to wait until it stabilizes. Don't just say, put it in to get it immediately, give it a few seconds. But also, just as importantly, you don't want the tip of the thermometer to be touching the glass, either the bottom or the sides. So make sure it's not touching the glass when you're getting your reading. Also, don't forget to write down the readings that you're getting them, because you can't go back, really, for a reason I'll describe in a second. As for boiling, just for the sake of safety, well, when I shut up, you're going to have to put on goggles today. You don't have to every week, but you do today. So while the whole time you're here, don't forget to take them off when you leave. You probably won't. But put them on, and that means put them on your eyes, not on your forehead. But also for safety's sake, you're going to be using glass balls as boiling chips. Just two or three of these in each container that you're using to boil. Is enough. So put those in and then deliver your liquid in after you measure it. And that will keep it from boiling out of control. You'll hear them tinkle. But that's why you have this, what the hell are these called? strainer.
Strainer here.
Because I don't want you to put the glass balls down the sink. Right. It's okay to put your solutions down the sink because it's just salt water. Today it is, at least. But pour them through this first so that you can get the beads out. If the bucket gets close to the top, don't just keep pouring into it. Empty the bucket, but keep the beads out. That's all that's there for. You have two sets of solutions, so if there's a line over there, just use one of these. They're duplicates. Now, the only other thing really that can go wrong here is, well, I guess two things. Is to be ambiguous with respect to what you consider boiling to be, and to wait too long to get your measurement. Boiling doesn't happen like that. You know, it doesn't go from no boil at all to a full wrap roiling boil, right? It simmers first. You get a bubble or two and more bubbles. And somewhere in there is boiling. But what is it? Well, that matters because there's going to be different temperatures as it goes through that range. And there is no perfect answer here. The point is, you as a group, and you should work at least in pairs, you need to be consistent for all of your replicates. Your four different solutions are your replicates. All right. So before you start heating them up, come to a consensus as a group as to what you're going to call boiling. It shouldn't be the very first bubble you see, but you also probably shouldn't wait until it's out of control boiling. The point is, decide what you're going to say boiling is and get your temperature at that same boiling definition for each of your replicates. All right? Here's why you shouldn't wait until it's boiling out of control. For the pure water one, it wouldn't matter. And that's because if you heat up, this is not the graph you make, but if you made a graph of temperature versus time, if you kept your thermometer in there the whole time as you heated it up and made it, had a computer graph being generated, of course, the temperature would rise as you heat the water until you hit the boiling point of water, which, by the way, is not 100 centigrade exactly. Here, we are not in standard conditions. We're not at sea level. So don't expect it to be 100 exactly. Don't just write down 100. That's not science. You have to actually get a measurement. But anyway, it will rise until you hit boiling point. When you hit boiling point, the temperature is going to stay the same, even though you're adding more and more heat. The more and more heat just goes into converting more and more liquid water into gaseous water. The temperature will stay the same until it's all gas, and if you were collecting that into a chamber and still heating it, then it would continue to heat up. And therefore, any time in this range where you take the temperature, it would be fine because the temperature doesn't change. But that's pure water only. You're using, for the other three, mixtures of salt and water. All right? Now, when you boil a saltwater solution, what is it that actually is evaporating? What's changing from liquid to gas? Not the entire solution, just the water. You have to get salt a hell of a lot hotter than you have to get water before it turns into a gas. And this is why if you totally forgot you're boiling with some salt water on the stove and you come back later with a totally dry pan, there's salt in the bottom of the pan still. No water at all. So it's only the water that leaves. Okay? If you wait a long time after it's already boiled before you get your temperature, what have you done? You've changed the concentration, which is the thing that you're trying to control, right? Because the more water leaves, the less water that's left behind, in other words, the stronger that solution gets. It's the same amount of salt in less water now, therefore it's more highly concentrated. You don't want that to happen. So get your measurements early on in the boiling. Make a early on definition of boiling and stick to it. Any questions on any of that? All right. Well, then you probably should go ahead and crank your heaters. Just remember they're on, so don't touch them, just so that they heat up while you get everything prepared. You can also put more than one container on one heater if you want to efficiently use your time.